If you were given the chance to retell someone's harrowing, God-soaked story, could you do it? Especially if it was someone famous whose faith and subsequent actions saved many lives. That's exactly what A.S. Pete Peterson was called to do. Thanks to an invitation, he wrote a play adaptation that later became a cinematic stage production of Corrie ten Boom's The Hiding Place. Pete takes us through the breadcrumb trail that led to his incredible project. Welcome to Fiction That Forms Us, stories that inspire us and practices that help us change. A podcast where we explore life-changing stories with characters whose journeys give us a vision for a better way of life. Through God's invitation and grace to practice spiritual disciplines, we can journey toward becoming fully human like Jesus as we live in the kingdom of God in the here and now. Welcome to the first episode of season 2. We are delighted to be back and have some wonderful guests this season. We're excited to dive in, but first I wanted to say a brief word about independent artists. We spend much of our time honing our craft and producing our work, many hours of which are not compensated. While we personally take pleasure in crafting and producing something of value and sharing it with others, it will help spread the value of our podcast if you could go on your podcast streaming app and give us an honest rating. In addition, if you've been enjoying what you hear, on our website we have a link to Ko-fi, a virtual tip jar, where you can support our work by buying me a book. With a little help from you, we can continue to keep this podcast advertisement free. If you're like me, when you hear podcast hosts asking you to support their work, you think, seriously? How expensive is it to produce conversation? Now that I have my own podcast, I understand why podcasts need financial support. I can't speak for others, but for us, paying for all of the platforms connected with the podcast and the incredible amount of time to put one together from reading the books or watching the shows or movies, taking subsequent deep dives into each one, such as note-taking, producing the podcast, which involves listening, editing, re-listening, and stitching together podcast parts, and finally, the writing, which involves intros and outros, show notes, and episode and guest information for the website. It's a great deal of unpaid independent work. For me, recording the actual episode is both the best part and the least of my work. I also kind of like reading the books too. So after one season under our belt, I understand and I hope you do too. If you enjoy our podcast, we welcome your support. I also want to say a word of thanks to our guests from whom our podcast demands much time. And now to the show. I'm your host, Christy Lahota, and today we're going outside of our fiction bounds to discuss Corrie ten Boom's The Hiding Place with Pete Peterson and his play adaptation turned cinematic stage production. While Corrie's book is not fiction but a true story, Pete's adaptation does take a few liberties, setting the scene at various times for what could have happened that we aren't told within the book's pages. Fiction That Forms Us exists to explore how each episode's story points us to God's story, and The Hiding Place is a true story that does just that. Pete's retelling brings Corrie's story to life for new generations. A.S. Peterson, welcome to Fiction That Forms Us.
Yeah, thanks.
Now you go by Pete, right?
I go by Pete.
Okay. Yes.
Because I don't care for either of my first names, and I figured C.S. Lewis set a precedent, and I'm going to hold to it.
I like it. So welcome, and it's good to meet with you. I'm curious, will you take us through for a synopsis?
Sure. So for anybody that doesn't know, the Hiding Place is a story of the Ten Boom family, who were a family in Harlem in the Netherlands, just outside of Amsterdam. And during World War II, they took it upon themselves, or a Christian family, to hide the Jews in their community from the Nazis. And over the course of the war, they ended up having over 800 people pass through their house. They would hide them at their house temporarily while these people were on sort of an underground railroad being transported to safety. And prior to the end of the war, the Nazis caught on, raided the house, arrested the entire Ten Boom family, and sent them off to prison. Interestingly, the Nazis never found the hidden Jews, and the Jews did escape. But the consequences of their actions were that Corrie is essentially the only survivor of her family. But she comes out of that experience, you know, with a whole kind of new view of the world.
You actually have been steeped in this for probably quite a while now.
Yeah. Interestingly, it's not a book that I've been familiar with like for my whole life. I didn't encounter it when I was younger. I knew Corrie Ten Boom's name, but I just kind of knew it generally. I didn't really understand what it was associated with. And you know, I guess it was about 5 years ago now, I got a call from a friend of mine who ran a theater company in Texas. And interestingly, that theater company was founded by Jeanette Clift George. Jeanette Clift is the actress who played Corrie in the film in the 70s. So she was highly acclaimed for playing that role. And then she went on to found this theater company. She passed away a few years ago, and they built a giant new theater in downtown Houston that's now called the Jeanette Clift George Theater. And one of the ways that they kind of christened that theater was by commissioning me to write an adaptation of The Hiding Place, since she was so closely associated with it. And so when I got the call, I was flattered and immediately said, okay, well, I'm interested, but let me go read the book and make sure I think it's a story that I'm suited to tell. So I went home that weekend and read through the book and just really loved it, immediately saw its potential and why people, you know, are so drawn to it. So yeah, I said yes, and then began the process of adapting it. So since then, it's been through multiple iterations. My wife and I have been to Amsterdam and Harlem. We've crawled into The Hiding Place. We've been to Ravensbrück concentration camp where Corrie and Betsy end up, you know, which was a powerful experience, you know, even standing in front of the oven where Betsy left, you know, the mortal realm is pretty powerful. And anyway, so I came back from that experience ready to write, and I threw myself into it. It opened in Houston at the 80 Players George Theater in, I think, 2018 or 19. I can't remember which. And lots of good reviews, sold out audiences. I think it was, you know, they sold more seats to that show than anything they ever done. That's not due to me. That's thanks to Corrie, to be clear. But we were really happy with the show. And I came home to Nashville, to my theater community, saying, hey, let's do this in Nashville because I really think it's a good piece of work. And before we could get that far, COVID kind of shut the whole theater scene down. So the director that I work with and I talked a lot about it during COVID and actually took the opportunity to push the story even farther than I had originally. And so rewrote it, and the show that premiered in Nashville last summer, which was the fruit of all that further development, is a much different show in some ways. And I think it's a much more coherent, that's a bad word. It's not like the first one was incoherent, but I really feel like we found the right way to tell that story in this new production. And it was just a phenomenal cast, phenomenal crew, a phenomenal production all the way around. I was so proud of it. And one of the frustrating things about theater is, you know, when you close the show, it's just gone forever. That experience evaporates into thin air. And so that's something that we've always regretted because we're so proud of the work of the community here. And so with this one, we actually took advantage of the opportunity we've been given to capture it on film. So a filmmaking couple that we are friends with here in town ended up coming in and I hesitate to say that it's filmed theater because while that is true, the way that they've captured the film is cinematic. So the camera is moving, the camera is up on stage inside the scene. And the result is something that's much more like a movie than I think most people are watching when you see a play on screen. So it's we've got a lot of good feedback from it, and I'm really excited about it. So throughout all that process, to answer your original question, I've had my head in the space of The Hiding Place for a long time now. Really working through multiple angles of that story. And it's been a real privilege for me. And it's also really humbling because, I mean, I'm a novelist, I'm a writer, I'm a playwright, and I've done some stuff that I'm really proud of. But none of it is anything like finding yourself in the position of being able to carry on the legacy of somebody like Corrie Ten Boom, who is so beloved throughout the world. And it was terrifying. You know, because we didn't want to drop the ball. We didn't want to get this wrong. But I also needed to be able to tell the story in my own way. And so it was really encouraging to meet with people after the audience comes out of the play, and so many people coming up and saying, this is my favorite book in the whole world, and this was perfect. And, you know, thank you for getting this right.
Wow.
That's a huge sigh of a relief for me.
Yeah, I can only imagine the burden that you felt with needing to relay that in such a powerful way.
Yeah, it really was scary. And the reality is, you know, a stage play is not a book. You can't just take the book and put the words on stage. That's not how adaptation works. So going into this, knowing that we are not going to present exactly what people experience when they read her book, but what we need to do is find a way to present it in three dimensions on stage in a way that people feel is honoring of her story and of the person that she was, and that gets across the same things that the book was getting across. And so, you know, while we change things quite dramatically sometimes, the hope is that we're achieving the same effect.
Yeah.
And I think we hit pretty close. I'm pretty proud of it.
As you were talking, I just got chills and I realized that hopefully I can make it through this interview without crying, because that didn't happen with my read through of the book, my reread.
Yeah, me either. And I got to tell you, the experience of reading the book for the first time and then within a couple of months, find yourself in the hiding place and in Ravensbrück concentration camp was just chilling. And, you know, the experience that my wife and I had in Germany was, you know, we took the tour, we went through the whole thing, and then it's just so emotionally heavy that when we got back in the car that evening, we just sat there and cried for a good 10 minutes. Because I don't even know how to respond to it.
Yeah,
I've often talked about the experience of going to a concentration camp as being sort of like the opposite of going to the Grand Canyon. Have you been to the Grand Canyon?
Actually, just last November, I went on a Renovare retreat, and we made it up there.
So you'll understand this analogy, I think. Like, you spend your life seeing pictures of the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, that's pretty. That's really cool. But then when you walk up to the rim and really see how big it is, you're just like, oh my gosh, none of these pictures did it justice. It's so much more than you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you go to a concentration camp, it's like you've seen the movies, you've seen Schindler's List, you've heard the history, but until you stand in front of an oven where tens of thousands of people were disposed of, and you see the real size of it, you can't really appreciate how big and how evil it actually is.
Yeah.
It was really chilling. And one of the most chilling things for me was that it's a kind of evil that involved creativity.
Hmm.
Because the camps, we went to Ravensbrück and Dachau, and the camps are specifically built in some instances to fool people into thinking something else is going on. So like the gas chamber is designed like a shower, so that the prisoners think they're going into a shower, and then they're gassed, and then there's a door that opens right into the crematorium next to it. And so what that implies is the creativity of an architect who's been directed to sit down and come up with an efficient way to dispose of human beings. And like that level of creativity applied to evil is something that I've never really considered before. I think we tend to think of evil as something that kind of happens in the moment or happens by mistake, when people didn't really know what they were doing. And like, that is not the case at all. Like, there was this enormous power of creativity that was brought to bear in order to get rid of that many people that efficiently. And it's more horrifying than you can really get across. So I don't think any story that you can ever tell is going to capture all of it, which is why we need to keep telling the story.
Yeah. I think as you spoke, I was just thinking about how that just enlightens us to how creative Satan and the demonic force actually are.
And how fallible we are.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, what's interesting is, either Dachau or Ravensbrück, you go through the whole story. It's really well put together as a museum to help you experience how it developed and how it spiraled into this overwhelming darkness. And so if you've experienced all that, then I remember we walked into a room where, are you old enough to remember phone books?
Yes.
So phone books, for those of you who don't know, were these big, thick books with really, really thin paper and very tiny type on them, on each page. And each page is just a list of names and phone numbers. And so at the concentration camp, there is what looks like a phone book that is the name and death date of every person who died in that camp. And so you flip through the names and you just can't believe how many it is. And then the horrifying thing is you walk into the next room and there's this giant map that shows a red dot for every camp in Europe. And every one of those camps has another phone book. And
how many were there?
Oh, there's hundreds. They're all over Germany and Poland, and I didn't realize
there were so many. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The scale of it is unimaginable.
You know, she said in her novel, when they entered Ravensbrück, they'd just gotten off the train from a different concentration camp, Vought, I think.
Oh, yeah, right.
And they were packed in like sardines, like double the amount that should have been in there. And it took 4 days and they didn't get to get out. So they were just, yeah. I hadn't even thought about it until she mentioned it, but just the, you know, one needs to relieve themselves and they didn't have that opportunity, but she gets there and she said, like infants on hands and knees, we crawled to the opening and lowered ourselves over the side. In front of us was a smiling blue lake. On the far side among sycamore trees rose a white church steeple. And it just, that's so chilling to know that right there.
Well, that's one of the things. Before I had been to Germany, I'd always kind of assumed that these concentration camps were off in the woods somewhere, hidden, so that there was a plausible deniability by the people who lived in the area. And at Ravensbrück, it's right on the shore of that lake, and you can see the town across the lake, and it's not a big lake. It was in, you know, operation for years. And for the first several years, all of the bodies were just taken to town to be burned. And it was only once the town couldn't keep up with the volume of bodies that they built a crematorium at Ravensbrück. So the idea that the town didn't know what was going on is completely ludicrous.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, in the defense of those villagers, that part of the reason they didn't speak up is because they knew if they did, they were going to be the next one up the smokestack.
Yeah, they would just be whisked off.
Right.
I wonder, you know, I often think about how would we respond today to situations like this? And when there's such systemic evil, it's like, how do you as a few people fight like the ultimate force? Like, how could those townspeople really have done? And I think even some of the, as we saw in Corey's novel, there were people within the concentration camps. I don't know how many, but they were subtly trying to help them in ways that they could while still, you know, being there and working. So I don't know. I don't really have a connection with Corrie ten Boom or the story, but I think I might have mentioned it to you, but our listeners wouldn't know. This summer, 2 years ago, I had the chance to go to Washington State to visit a friend, and she took me to visit Marty and Lynn Enzine. And Marty had been a longtime member of the Renovari family on the board of directors and also on the ministry team. And she and her husband had been medical missionaries over in Rwanda and Burundi. And during that time, she had the chance to meet Corrie ten Boom, and they became close friends. And she would often go visit her in California when Corrie lived there. But it was a delight to get to have lunch with them and then go over to their house. And Lynn has since passed, but Marty, I mean, they were both in their 90s, but she must have been in her 40s when she first met Corrie. So that just...
Yeah, it's been really remarkable in this process to meet so many people who had direct personal connections with her.
Wow.
Which only intensified my terror, you know?
Right.
So then, like I said, it was encouraging to hear some of those people experience the play and just say thank you. This did the job.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. So how long have you been writing novels and working on plays?
Yeah. So I've been writing all my life in some form or fashion. I started writing my first novel around 2000. Eventually that ended up being published in 2009. And that's, you know, it's a Revolutionary War adventure novel. It and its sequel are part of the same story. And since then, I've longed to get back to novel writing, but I just haven't had time. I've gotten into short story writing, which I really enjoy. And then along about 2014, I got involved in plays. And theater was not something I had studied specifically or had even experienced in a great detail. I loved Les Mis, I loved Phantom of the Opera, Miss Saigon, all these things. But I hadn't really studied as an art form. I was, however, a film student in college, so I was familiar with the script format, and there's similarity between a script for a film and a play. So when somebody in town here asked me if I would, you know, work on a project with them, it wasn't too big a bridge to cross for me. And it was really fun. And it was interesting that the director I work with now, his name is Matt Logan. He was looking to develop a new version of Cinderella because he found himself producing Rodgers and Hammerstein's show a lot. And that's not really a great show. and he just thought there's got to be a better version of Cinderella out there. So he asked me if I would be willing to write it. And I was like, sure, why not? And so we went through a development process working on that show, which really ultimately taught me how to write theater. And we never produced the show. It ended up being too long, unworkable. It was just me figuring it out. But in that process, I went to see every show here in town that I could get my hands on, just really immerse myself in the art form. And so a few years later, he got a grant to write a stage adaptation of the Battle of Franklin. So Franklin is a small town just outside of Nashville that was host to one of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War. There's a lot of historical interest in it. And it's not one of the stories like Gettysburg that gets told very often. So we decided to put it on stage as a stage show. And so that was the first thing that we went through and completed. And it was really an interesting project because they had already, when they called me and asked if I would do it, they were already selling tickets. And they were selling tickets, say, in an evening of stories and songs, the Battle of Franklin. And so I said, what do you want me to write? And he's like, well, you can kind of, whatever. It could just be music with little vignettes or whatever you want to do. And I was like, okay. So I went to work on it and ended up coming back with a fully fledged play that it has a musical component. I hesitate to say that it is a musical because it's not sung through. And there's only about 7 songs total. So it's not as much music as you normally think of with a musical, but music is a huge component. And that was a great experience. Like, we developed the whole thing here with local actors, local musicians, put it on stage, sold out every show, and it was really proud of it. And then we actually did it again the following year and sold out those shows as well. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that show has a huge set of legs beyond Nashville because it's such a local interest story. So I don't know that, you know, it'll ever be widely available, but it was a great working experience for me and the theater community here in town. We really clicked. And so right as that show was closing, you know, Matt, the director, told me, he's like, hey, you know, I've always wanted to do Frankenstein on stage. And next year is the 200th anniversary of the publication of Mary Shelley's novel. How would you feel about adapting Frankenstein? And I was like, oh my gosh, yes, please. Because I'm a language guy. Like, I love Shakespeare, you know, and Frankenstein and, you know, that early Victorian time period is very language based. And I just jumped on it because I'd loved the book for years, but had never seen any adaptation that I felt like came anywhere near representing what Mary Shelley had created. Because all the adaptations we see of Frankenstein are about, you know, the dangers of science, and it's a monster movie. And while those things are certainly aspects of that story, the thing that I love about it is it's a deeply theological story because it's about the relationship of the creation to its creator. And in the case of Frankenstein, the creator is antagonistic toward his creation, and that causes his creation to become monstrous. And like, I was really interested in how is that different from our relationship with our creator? Because in the context of the story, the monster, his entire worldview is formed by reading Paradise Lost. He takes it as a true history of the world. So he approaches everything that happens to him in terms of, I am the Adam of this man, and he should be treating me better than this. So anyway, it's a fascinating story, and I wanted to capture that angle of it in the terms of a stage, a language play. So, you know, it's written in almost entirely iambic meter, you know, so it sounds much more like Shakespeare when you hear it. And so we put that on stage, and it won, you know, some awards that year, sold out all of its shows, great reviews. And then we came out of that experience thinking, hey, let's get the whole cast into the studio and do an audio play version of it. So we did that, and that was also nominated for some awards and turned out really well. And that was, so there's this kind of breadcrumb trail that leads us to The Hiding Place, where when we did The Hiding Place on stage, and once again, it was just enormously popular, very proud of it. We thought, can we capture this so that we have an artifact of this work so that it doesn't vanish entirely? Yeah. And so rather than the audiobook this time, we thought, well, let's do it in film. So we worked with Tony and Laura Matula, who are wonderful filmmakers here in town, to capture something that's really a dynamic cinema experience of the play. And we screened it for the first time for the cast and crew just 2 weeks ago.
I was going to say was recently, right?
No, it was last week. Yeah, it was last week. And it was so much fun for me after having worked with these people so much in the last few years. Like, I kind of realized that, you know, you don't do all this work to put a play up on its feet so that audiences can love it. And then there's this sort of tragic realization when you, as the creator of it, realize that none of those beautiful people on stage creating this thing ever get to see it, you know, because they're inside of it.
Right.
You know, there is a sense in which, especially for The Hiding Place, which was told in a kind of non-linear format, because there are a lot of flashbacks to, like, her childhood and stuff. Like, there were actors that didn't even fully understand why they were coming on stage at certain times. And I'm like, trust us, it makes sense when you're in the audience. And so to have the privilege of showing the film to that group of people was just one of the highlights of my life. I was so proud of them.
Join us next time for part two of this interview, where we discuss Betsy and Corey as witnesses to God's theodicy. They proclaimed God's goodness as they lived through deep evil and darkness. In fact, Corey went on to spend the rest of her life testifying to God's goodness. Join us as we explore how they teach us about faith and the spiritual practice of saying yes to God. This powerful cinematic stage production, The Hiding Place, is now available for streaming on the Lamb and Flagg Studios website, lambandflaggstudios.com, or click the link to it on our website. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Fiction That Forms Us. To read articles, learn more about this episode's guest, as well as what we've discussed, visit fictionthatformsus.com. Connect with us on social media through Facebook and Twitter. You can find links to those also on our website. This podcast was produced by Rob Lahota. Our theme music is All Flame from the Carolyn Ahrens album, Recognition. Learn more at carolynahrens.com. May God grace us with more of His presence as we learn to fully live in the kingdom of God by aligning our will with God's will. Until next time, omnia corda inflammate, set every heart on fire.